Welcome to For the Record, an unfiltered view on current trends and timeless advice for surviving in the aesthetics industry. Whether you're an injector, practice owner, sales rep, or marketer, it's time to set the record straight. Each week, we cut through the chaos and showcase diverse perspectives and winning ideas from the best minds in the industry. I'm your host, Dr. Tiffany Hall, Chief Growth Officer at Aesthetic Record. Now, let's get started on this week's episode. Hey guys, welcome back to our season finale of For the Record. This is episode 60, and I could not be more thrilled and more excited to have our guest on today. When I think about the bucket list of all FTR guests ever in the history of my bucket list, she is in my top three for sure. We have on today Shelby Miller, who needs no introduction of any sort. She is an incredible injector. She has a gorgeous practice in Utah, which is now in a bigger, more immaculate, more amazing location. She also has an incredible training program called Rumba Academy, which is taking over. She's traveling nonstop all around the country, literally on a plane, I feel like every day somewhere, training in practices. Also a mom to two precious little girls, a wife, a speaker at podiums everywhere. She is really all over the place. I have no idea how she does it. We'll find out today. But she's here in the flesh. And the fun thing about Shelby is that no matter all the success, the influencer, the injector, skill set, all the things, she's just an amazing person who is genuine, sweet, down to earth, and does things for the right reasons. And I could not be more thrilled to welcome today to our show, our guest, Shelby Miller. Welcome to our show.
Wow, what an intro. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, you know, I'm like fan club VIP president number one, huge fan of yours. I met you at AmSpa, like, I don't know, 6 years, many years ago, and thought, who is this person? And I listened to you do a talk about something. I was like, you're going to be huge. And my goodness, you are huge.
Oh my gosh. It goes way back to Galderma days.
Oh yeah. Right? Like a long, long, long time ago. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Forever ago. And I always joke that having Tiff as a best friend is a dream of mine. So we're working on that.
Well, I don't know how we'd have time to do it between my schedule and your schedule.
I know.
But I think that's what people want to know about you. I look at you and think, I do a lot of stuff, but you do way more than I do. And so I want to unpack all that today. But I want to start, people who don't really know, you've been doing this for quite a while. You're not new to this game. I mean, you had a meteoric rise to success, but you've been putting in a long list of hours and years getting great at your craft. So where did you start and how did you end up here in aesthetics?
Okay, that's actually an interesting question. I actually wanted to be a CRNA. I wanted to work anesthesia for plastics. I was always interested in plastics, but it's kind of hard to get in. So I was working in the high acuity ICU in the state of Utah, recovering open heart surgeries and pulmonary procedures, vascular procedures, because you have to work ICU in order to get into a CRNA program. So I was hustling, did some travel nursing doing that. And finally got a part-time gig with plastic surgeons in an OR, two body plastic surgeons. And I was so excited. And I go into work and the first week I was just floored, devastated, because I was so freaking bored in the OR. I could not handle it. I wanted I thought it would be more, you know, and I think I learned that I'm very much a people person. So one of these CRNAs was an injector and she would show me some before and after pictures. I kept the job because I wanted to try to navigate what I could do within plastics. And she showed me some before and after pictures of filler. And this was almost a decade ago when in Utah, filler was so taboo. And I remember her showing me this chin filler before and after with someone with literally no chin to this incredible, beautiful jawline after. And I'm like, you did that with a gel? Are you kidding me? So I was kind of obsessed from day one. Transitioned, started working with a facial plastic surgeon and started injecting there. And that's where I started my Instagram account. And I think I got lucky with timing because that was before there was many injectors on social media. And I would show the behind the scenes and explain everything. And because it was kind of taboo, I think it kind of took off. And people were like, what is this girl doing? And I was just showing everything and just keeping it real and started my career there, built my clientele and just got busier and busier, and then transitioned and worked at a different med spa for a couple of years, and then started Ruma.
So what year did you start Ruma? Because I feel like Ruma has been around as long as I've known you. You had a D&P somewhere along the way in there. You had a nurse practitioner, doctor nursing practice. Like, you've done all this in the meantime. So where did all of that fit into CRNA and starting practice?
So after I worked with a facial plastic surgeon for a couple of years, they tried to ping me in a 50-mile non-compete, but also there was a lot of cultural things going on. Anyways, I transitioned to a different med spa and worked there for a couple of years. And we can get into kind of why I started Ruma, but the timeline was, it was 2018, and I had 6 months left of my doctorate program. And I was doing tons of clinicals, just stacking my residency, because you have up to 7 years to complete this BSN to DMP program. And the quickest you could do it in is 3.5 years. And you better believe I cranked that out. So I'm in the end of this condensed doctorate program, 6 months left. And I get pregnant, and I'm 6 weeks pregnant. Actually, prior to that, I had gotten pregnant, but I miscarried at 6 weeks. So this was the second time I had been pregnant, and I was 6 weeks pregnant again. And I kind of had a sit down, come to Jesus conversation with the business owner where I was working, and realized that all of my core values were compromised, and it was no longer the right place for me. So I, the last thing she really said to me was, I need you to look inside yourself and decide if you still want to work for my company. And I was like, you're right. I need to look inside myself. And I walk out of there and I call one of my friends and I'm like, hey, can you be my medical director? I just don't think I can do this anymore. I can't find a place where I feel at home. And I need to just do my own thing. And can you be my medical director? So 6 weeks pregnant, 6 months left in my doctorate program, I start Ruma in 2018. And seemed like a good idea, you know, when it rains, it pours, why not? And so that's when Ruma was born, and we started out of one little room. I think it's all about who you know. In the beginning, one of my clients owned this really cute beauty bar where they had hair and nails and a boutique and some estheticians, but no medical. And she's like, we got a room in the back shelf. Come on over. You can do this. And 10 days later, after that conversation with that owner, I started Ruma, and I was injecting people in one little room, 10 by 12, 120 square feet.
And how big is it now? I mean, it's like massive now.
We're 10,000 square feet. So we were looking, so we started in one little room, and that was always temporary. She was so kind too. Becky Burstell, who's actually number one woman to John Maxwell. If any of you guys are business owners, you know who John Maxwell is. If you have been in the leadership space long enough, I'm sure you've read one of his books. But she runs his entire non-for-profit. She is just absolutely incredible and a longtime patient and friend of mine. And she didn't even charge me rent. She's like, just come on over. I want your patients in my building. If they can pay for Botox, they can pay for nails and hair and clothes. So it was a good, mutual relationship, but she was so kind. It took us 9 months to find a place to do a build out, and then COVID hit. So our first build out was in the middle of COVID. So we went from 120 square feet to 2750, a little less than 3000 square feet. And it was amazing. The space was beautiful, but we grew out of it after 12 months, which was devastating, because I think that's one of my biggest mistakes, not thinking big enough. But we had 30 times our space. You know, we came from one room to, you know, almost 3000, and then ended up having to find a bigger space. So I don't know, we are kind of at a point where, and I'm sure you've seen this, Tiff, in our industry especially, when you're at the point and you either do two locations or even split and do three smaller locations, or we had a decision to just go bigger and have one mothership. And I think I really had to kind of dig deep and focus on why I started Ruma, which is to create a space where you can provide incredible quality, focus on safety and innovation, but also have an incredible culture for your team. And I feel like if you split too quick or the second you have multiple locations, you compromise quality and you compromise culture real quick. So I was not willing to compromise on that. And so we just decided to build the mothership, and now we're in 10,000 square feet. So three times that. And it's been amazing, and it's allowed a lot of room for growth, and a lot of doors have kind of opened with having this type of space. But it's definitely not cheap. I think you have to, you know, think big picture, you know, but I also realize, you know, when you're providing such an amazing type of quality and result for your patients, they will drive to you, they'll fly to you. We have patients from out of state at least weekly here. So, if I were to open a second location, it probably would not be within Utah, because our patients are from everywhere within Utah. So it's where we're at, Tiff.
Well, I think you have so many good decision points there, thinking about location, because I feel like when you look at Ruma on Instagram, which is where most of us see Ruma as a practice, I feel like the whole practice is Ruma. It's not just you. I think you've done a really good job of making it not Shelby's injectable spa. You know, you've really focused on everyone there feels like they're woven into the Ruma tapestry. And when you have locations upon locations, that is very hard to do. If you don't get that centered right before you start growing, you just multiply problems over time. So I feel like that's a thing that you've done that's very different. But also, you know, the mothership affords you a place to train. You can do all these trainings there now. You can grow your business. You can have other things coming in out of your space. Like, it's just different to have a giant location is to have a lot of tiny ones everywhere, you know, all around. So I, for one, think it's a genius idea. But I look at your practices, the one that you had before this one too, and think they're so beautiful. Like, I can't imagine what goes into it, from both an investment of time and money to make them look what they look. And then whenever you're ready to leave them, can someone even afford to take them over because they're so gorgeous? But you spend time on every single detail, which I think speaks to you as an injector also. I think you're just a very detail-oriented person. But they're gorgeous. So how much time and investment does that take, not even money-wise, but just mentally, to get all that done where it's where you want it to be?
Oh, you know, it's funny. I had a conversation about this with Justin Harper, because I think we have completely different takes on business, completely. And they both work, which is the amazing thing. But man, it was an investment. So the first space, because we didn't have to pay rent for almost a year and a half, I actually just really hunkered down and paid for every penny of it as we built it out. And that cost us almost $400,000, because we stripped the space to the metal studs and had no TI, because that was a sublease. So kind of stupid and a little bit of a risk, but like, did it pay off? Absolutely. We ended up being in that space for 2 years, because we had two and a half years, because we had to do this whole build out. And I don't even know, millions in revenue. So that was nothing. Like, it was paid off. But we did a lot of the work ourselves. I wanted these gorgeous modern slat walls, and no one can build them around here. So my husband and I, who Jordan has a little bit of a background in cabinetry, we get these white oak 2x2 strips, and we're sanding every edge, staining them, sanding them, coating it. And I developed freaking tendonitis from doing that myself. But we have these bomb, more like modern slat walls that no one else had, and it's gorgeous. And now there's like slat walls all over med spas. But you know, this is back, you know, years ago, and I just wanted a super clean, modern, like different look. I think if you go into a lot of med spas, it just feels like kind of a slightly elevated doctor's office. And Ruma is different. We've always pulled the high-end clientele, the patients that will pay more for better result, but also better experience. So when we're doing market research, I always charge a little bit more than everywhere else, because it draws the type of patient that's like, oh, why does Ruma charge more? They must be better. I'm going to go there. It's a different type of clientele. These patients are motivating, they're machines, they go, go, go. I learn so much from them. I want to be surrounded by people like that who are successful and driven and generous, because I'm still seeing patients 4 days a week. That's still so much of my world. And that's what I love surrounding myself with versus, you know, being kind of the discount shop, which there needs to be a Target and there needs to be a Chanel, you know, that's just how it goes. But we're definitely the higher end, and that's how we've been since day one. And I think that's really helped separate us, you know, from the pack as well.
Yeah, I think whatever you build, you know, your, what do they say, your tribe or your vibe attracts your tribe. I think it's the same way in a medical, in any physical space. Whatever you build out, whatever you create as your persona will attract that kind of clientele. Because people ask me a lot about, how do I get, you know, how do I make a practice like a Aruma or like a Glowderma or these practices who are, you know, beautiful and fun, and you want to be part of it. Like, you want to go there. You want to just like hang out there all day. It's like, because they built the space for that kind of patient. They built the space or created the space that draws that person in. And there is a big part of that. Your building becomes your brand as much as as much as your two hands are in so many ways. But you mentioned sanding walls. What I think is so remarkable about you, people probably don't know this about you, is, well, they probably do now, that you are a straight up hustler. Like, you work like a dog all the time. You work crazy hours. I think about Erica the same way. Like, you guys just, there's a reason why you're at the top, right? Because you put in the freaking work to do it. What is that in your background that makes you that way? I'm sure part of your upbringing gives you that sort of spark, but how do you decide every day that, you know, we're already giant, I'm already successful, let's just get more successful and more giant? Like, what drives that decision to keep on going?
You know, as an entrepreneur, I think there's something in your blood. You know, I think you're either a shark or you're a dolphin, and either's okay, but I think I'm definitely a shark. And I didn't think that in the beginning. My dad's an entrepreneur. Almost all of my siblings are entrepreneurs. So I think part of it is just something that's in me, and it's kind of how I've always been. I think part of it is also how I was brought up. My two other brothers were heroin addicts growing up. And, I watched them make terrible decision after terrible decision and just struggle. And I never wanted to cause my parents pain like they experienced from my brothers. So I think just something in me kind of turned on, and I was just self-motivated from being little, like 8 years old. And also kind of helped raise my little brother because during all of that. And so I think it created this independence and this just drive to be successful and to make just good decisions as a human. And luckily they're both sober now and actually are entrepreneurs. They own a rehab that just helps hundreds of addicts throughout Utah. And they're amazing and they're successful and they're passionate about what they're doing. But I think just like, you have to be passionate about what you're doing too. You know, I think, I love this. I heard this recently, and it's something along the lines of, the person who is passionate about what they're doing will always outwork you, because to them it's not work. Right. And this is why when I go on vacations, like last vacation we went on to Bora Bora with my husband, 10 days in Bora Bora, what do? Oh, Shelby's reading a 600-page ultrasound book because that's fun to her. And I read the whole thing on my trip to Bora Bora, but it was just amazing. And that was fun to me. I mean, did I come out of it way more understanding of ultrasound? Yes. Did I have to do that? No, it was technically probably considered work, but I'm so passionate about what I'm doing and I love it so much that part of it is the fact that it's just not work to me.
Yeah, but I think you live a very rich life in the sense that you go do, you know, you're snow skiing, you're on the water. I think you have a good, what appears to be a good balance from the outside, because I don't have that. I feel guilty about having hobbies, because if I'm doing a hobby, then I'm not working. And then if I'm not working, people aren't making money and, you know, all the things, as you know, business, payroll and all the things you have to do. But I feel like you make it look as if you have some kind of a balance, which I think is remarkable, but it does look like it's fun for you. And I think people who go into this industry thinking, I'm going to be able to work part-time, or I'm going to be able to have these great hours and become Shelby or become Lori Robertson or become Erica or become, you know, any of these people. It's like, that's not real life. This is a grind, and you better love it, because if you don't love it, the grind really sucks, but it is a grind. But you've now gone from this, you know, sort of persona, I wouldn't say entertainer, but you are definitely a social influencer. People love to watch your information, your posts, your educational, you know, components, but you're also a damn good injector, like a really, really good injector. I mentioned to you in one of our notes here that Scott Callahan has said you're one of the best injectors he's ever seen, period, which is from him a very tall compliment. You have incredible skill. So how do you have time to learn and craft your own skill and learn and craft your own techniques and proprietary methods while you're also teaching the rest of the world how to do their own things too?
Oh man, that's a good question. I think I like to think differently. I think it's important to ask why, because a lot of the time, if you think about how injectors learn in our industry, they'll learn from a trainer and this is how you do cheek filler, right? And then that's how they do it for the next 10, 20 years, right? But it's amazing to me in my training academy, the questions that I ask the trainees and their inability to answer them shocks me. For example, where are you depth-wise when you're injecting this? What are you looking out for? Where are your lymphatics depth-wise? Because that's what I care about as an injector, right? How do I avoid them? Right? Or where are most of our blood vessels depth wise? Or just asking these questions that injectors should know, but instead they say, oh, I put it here because I was told to put it there. Okay, but let's think deeper. What is that affecting when you're putting that there? What is happening if you're placing it superficially here? What's going to happen over time? They don't ask questions, you know? And for me, I've always been the person that's like, okay, put it there, but why? I want to know why. And I think, starting with a facial plastic surgeon was really helpful because it's like a cadaver lab every single day, right? Seeing the face peeled back, deep plain facelifts, neck lifts, rhinos, blefs, just everything. But I also think there's a huge artistic component to what we do. And it's about learning from people that produce results that you think are beautiful and natural. Because I inject very different than Erica. I inject very different than Amy. And that's okay. I mean, they're good friends of mine. We all produce different types of results, right? So I think it's about learning from people that you think produce results that look natural or extra. I don't know, whatever you think is amazing and beautiful and what you want to produce for your patients, learning from people that do that is helpful. You also just have to constantly be wanting to learn, even if you think you're at the top of your game, because that's when it gets dangerous, right? You cannot be complacent. Every time I push myself and do another training, I'm humbled over and over and over again. And I think it's also kind of scary to be a trainer because people ask you things and if you don't know the answer, you know, it's, and if you don't know the answer to something that you should, it's kind of embarrassing. But I've kind of learned to step back. And if I don't know the answer, I really dive deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and be okay with not knowing everything, because there's no way we can know everything, right? You just always, always have to be pushing yourself and be comfortable with being uncomfortable. You know, I got an ultrasound and I mean, I thought I knew anatomy. Tiff, it has completely changed my practice and has humbled me and has helped me really become a better provider. I think that alone over the last year has helped me become so much better at what I'm doing. Because I can actually visualize what I'm doing. You know, think about any other medical specialty, they utilize imaging. Why the heck are we not utilizing imaging? You know, I know it costs 20 grand, get over it. Like, it's going to make you a better, safer, more successful provider, because patients are also getting smarter. So many new patients come to us because they saw that we have an ultrasound. They saw what we're doing, what we're educating on, you know, and they see value in that. So I think it's important to just, you got to be pushing yourself, you know.
Well, the ultrasound thing is like, okay, so I'm glad you mentioned that, because here's what I think we've done, Shelby. This is my assessment. We put adverse events on Instagram and these like scary death-defying necrosis and things. Like, we've scared the shit out of people on Instagram with adverse events. Yeah. But then we've done nothing to say we can prevent it. So like, if you're a person who's out there putting adverse events on Instagram, or who's calling out other people's work and saying things about, you know, tear troughs swollen, all these things, but you don't have an ultrasound device or a way to understand how to not make the same mistake, it's almost like hypocritical. Like, you can't do both. And patients are coming and asking because they're scared to death that they're going to get hurt. And so you better have that device in your practice to say, nope, we've got ultrasound. We're looking at imaging. We're trying to find out, you know, how to best keep you safe. And I think about too, for our industry, I've had a nose job. So my anatomy is way different now, right? I've had rhinoplasty. So if you were to inject my nose with filler, you better know that things have moved. I feel like our industry, if any, is at a higher risk because we all have surgery on different things in our face. People have implants and things move around. So I feel like you almost have to know. But people who don't know how to use ultrasound in their practice, teaser, you'll be at Aesthetic Next 5 talking about how to really implement into your day-to-day operations for your practice. But that's, to me, a game changer that you didn't have to even do. You have had, you know, facial plastic surgery access. You've seen the alive cadaver, you know, on the table opened up, but you chose to do it. So I feel like those are the kind of things that set you apart. But how does that work into like your Rumba Academy offerings? Because you offer a lot of really interesting classes. Your staff also teaches as well, which is a whole different animal. How do you really bring all of that to trainees who are coming to you? Because they pay a pretty penny to come to you, which I know it's well worth it. But how does it all fit into what you're offering?
That's a loaded question. So let me start with ultrasound. I had only had exposure from having babies to ultrasound. And then when I worked in the ICU with echocardiograms, I had no idea what ultrasound even entailed. So I paid $6,000, went to an ultrasound course, and it went way over my head. Like, I walked out of there so like even more confused and a little bit down, because I was like, how am I ever going to get good at this? People have degrees in sonography, right? So I went to Bora Bora and I read this 600-page ultrasound book. I read a few others, did what I could do based on the resources that we have, which is pretty minimal with facial procedures in ultrasound, especially in aesthetics. So what I did is, we actually have a virtual training platform too. So I created a virtual 101 ultrasound course for injectors to take prior to an in-person expensive course. And I created it as I was learning it in a way that was more efficient and made more sense to my brain as an injector. And it breaks it all down. What is ultrasound technology? Where is it even from? How does it work? What does normal anatomy look like? Because most of the time, people be coming into your offices with crap all over their face, and it's abnormal anatomy. So if you don't understand what normal looks like, if you can't find the muscle in a normal face with nothing in it, you think you're going to be able to identify abnormal? There's no stinking way, right? So we really just broke down the 101 basics of ultrasound. And then once you get comfortable with that, go pay the $6,000 and do an in-person course and do guided ultrasound dissolving in nodules with rock hard shells around them, which is almost impossible, by the way, to get into a nodule without visualizing it, because they move away from you. Even with a huge 22 gauge needle, they will move away from you. We've taken care of some crazy issues now that we have an ultrasound. People send their issues to us, which I kind of love because I'm digging into it. And we've found lipomas, we found osteomas. I've found a dropped submandibular gland that this lady wanted Kybella in, thought it was fat. It was definitely a surgical procedure complication. Her gland had dropped down into her neck. And if we put deoxycholic acid in that would have been terrible. I mean, there's so many examples of why it's important, but kind of incorporating that into our training academy, every training now I whip out the ultrasound and show them the value of it and how you can be more precise and safer. Yes, you can use it when you have a vascular occlusion, but that's the last thing you're going to use it for. You know, I mean, mapping is helpful for dangerous areas, but being more precise with mapping before you use deoxycholic acid. What's the thickness of the preplatysmal fat? Let's measure prior, in between sessions, and after sessions. You went from 7 millimeters to 2. That's something you can actually quantify now and share that with your patient, right? Or like before any type of PLLA or dermal thickening product, measure the dermal thickness. And then after treatments or before Morpheus, measure how thick you need it, how thick the tissue is. And if you want to go deep and debulk, how deep do you need to go to get to the sub-Q? Be more accurate, like use your medical brain, right? Having these tools just helps you be better. So we help all of our trainees understand that. And I've partnered with Mindray. I mean, they have the best ultrasound on the market for what we do. So if anyone goes to like our website, ruma.com, you can see our partners page on the about, and there's a Mindray like ultrasound drop page where they can fill information out and get information on the ultrasound that we have. We have a partnership with them, so it gets a discount because they are expensive, but they see the value in that. And if you purchase an ultrasound, you get $500 off my virtual 101 course. So I don't know. I'm just trying to do as much as we can to help people see the value in safety. And then I've drawn all of our providers into this too, and two of our other injectors educate within Ruma Academy as well. So they do, they run our beginner course and then like area specific courses like lip courses or Sculptra Radius specific courses. And I think involving them has been awesome because it's also forced them to become really comfortable with what they're doing and to dive deeper and to know the basics and just really break it down. And it's been awesome.
Yeah. What you just said about ultrasound, I think you just used words and concepts there that the average injector would never think about. I mean, even like dermal thickness, people don't think about those things at all when they're injecting. I've been around too many trainings with GAIN to know that those are not the discussions that they're having. They're worried about, am I in a vessel? And, you know, especially for Sculptra, am I in a muscle or not, right? You know, the like high-level things. But I think about dermal thickening. You know, we haven't been able to get skin boosters approved in the U.S. for years because we have to have a biopsy of the dermis to see if it's thickened because of a skin booster. You could use ultrasound and solve that problem. Like we're trying to use Vectra for it, but Vectra's not nearly as good. Vectra's not an ultrasound device. I mean, you could solve that issue with this device.
Yeah, the amazing thing about the Mindray is there's two different probes. So I have a high frequency probe. It's called the L20. And so you can see tons of detail superficial in the skin. And you can really track those changes, which as an injector, I care about those things. I'm selling PLLA for $1,000 a vial. I want to be able to quantify that it's actually doing what I want it to be doing, right? Same thing with Kaha or... I mean, there's so many things to think about. I mean, especially with even our estheticians and empowering them to do a quick scan of the dermal thickness. I mean, that's incredible. And you have that tool. So being able to use it is awesome. And not all ultrasounds are created equal. The second you get comfortable, you're going to want a different type of probe, something that shows you more detail, higher frequency, a little bit more bandwidth. So that's why I chose Mindray versus over a handheld.
Yeah, I was talking to Dr. Stella last week because she's going to come to AN. She uses the GE, like the big giant one. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She's like, the only thing I would use besides that is the Mindray. She's like, that's what I would use as the Mindray. So certainly it's good. But you just mentioned your estheticians using it. Talk about elevating the esthetician in your practice to let them use an ultrasound device and have a discussion with an injector about the dermis and about thickening and just those conversations in front of a patient even. For them to see that, it's like, wow, this whole practice is like really on board with the medical aesthetics concept, not just, you know, a fluff and buff. Like that's a massive game changer, I think, for an esthetician to learn those skills. So that's, I love that. That's awesome.
Thank you. I think a lot of estheticians are a little nervous too, when it comes to the higher, I don't know, the Morpheus and the really strong devices, and they're worried about complications. So if you can empower them and educate them as to being a little bit more precise with their depth and where they're shooting the heat, I mean, it totally takes away that barrier. And now they're empowered to educate their patients even more and to get even better results. So it's worked out well.
I love it. Well, I want to change gears for a second because thinking about devices and things, you on a private plane is like my life, and seeing the girls with their little headphones on Jordan's plane is so cute. But I think about you travel constantly to train. You mentioned that you inject 4 days a week, and so your injections are obviously entails ultrasound and tons of product, and you've got, you know, your own staff to train, your own things going on, plus Rumo Academy, and now you're flying out different places. That's crazy town, Shelby. That's insane. I don't know how you do it, but what is the compelling reason why you hop on a plane all the time and you go train places? I mean, you're gone all the time. So how does that work? And by the way, I think for you probably is better to have the plane than it is to buy plane tickets as much as you're gone. So smart choice. But what's that whole setup look like?
Well, when you say it like that, it makes me sound like a psycho person.
Well, I mean, I didn't say that, but maybe.
Okay, so here's the thing. We have really good friends and our besties, and he grew up flying from a really young age. His grandfather was a pilot. So they took us on a trip to Vegas and in their private jet, and it ruined my husband because he's always wanted to fly for fun. Jordan's in finance. Jordan has worked wealth management. He's brilliant. And, but as a hobby, he thought it would be fun to just learn how to fly. You know, every little boy who doesn't want to learn how to fly airplanes, you know, I didn't think he was serious until after that Vegas trip. So he was like, "Hey, Shelb, I think I'm going to just start taking some lessons." And I'm like, "Okay, like that's benign, whatever, like have fun." Did not think it would roll into 6 weeks later, "Hey, Shelb, I'm going to buy a plane." I'm like, "What? What?" So we end up getting this little tiny prop plane, an SR-22, which is a Cirrus, which Cirrus planes have parachutes for the entire plane. So if the engine goes out, you pull the chute and the whole plane floats down instead of crash and burn, you know? So I was actually really against it until we talked to an aviation tax attorney, and he helped us understand the tax benefits of it. Because when you start to grow a business that has a lot coming in, there's also a lot that goes out to the government, and it's painful. So learning how you can be a little bit more strategic is actually, it was actually really shocking to me how helpful that could be. So I let him buy the plane. And then of course, I mean, this plane is not pressurized. So when we're trying to fly above 12,000 feet, you have to wear oxygen because it's not pressurized. So I wear these headsets and the little oxygen thing going in your nose. And I'm like, I have altitude sensitivity. So above 8,000, I start getting headaches, and it's not as bougie as it looks. This was the first plane that we had. And also you can't take kids because you have to wear your headset because it's loud. And then you think they'll keep oxygen in their nose 3 and 2 years old? No way. No way. So we ended up upgrading to a little jet, a Cirrus jet. It's like 7-person jet. So it's pressurized, it goes faster, more efficient, but still a Cirrus jet. So it still has the parachute safety, you know. Anyways, that's how we got into it. Long story short, Jordan is obsessed with flying. So he since has gone and gotten his like seaplane license so he can fly seaplanes. He got his commercial license for safety, but he's a really good pilot. So he flies me, which is actually fun because I travel a ton doing trainings. And I think that there's so much value in that. And I love doing that at least once a month, but we typically stack the trainings and we're really efficient about it. I think, yes, I work super hard, but I think it's about working smart, right? So I am really careful about my schedule, and we'll travel once a month and we stack trainings. And then it's kind of fun, like a little weekend away with my hubby. And so he flies me, we do dinners and try to make it fun. So I still do that once a month. And then majority of our trainings are in-house at Ruma now that we have the space and we have a full academy here. But that's kind of how it works. I mean, it's for tax purposes. It's also fun. It is a lifestyle thing. It's completely changed the way that we travel. It makes the world seem really small when you're up in the sky. It makes your problems seem really small. It kind of just puts things in perspective. And it's been a really great blessing for my marriage and for our family. But it is not a cheap hobby. But the tax benefits are helpful.
I love what you said about, you know, your marriage. I think about you're like tucking away together, you know, whether you're actually flying there and you're there together for the whole weekend. Like, I think there's a part of that where you are. I mean, I've, you know, obviously have had a divorce, unfortunately. There's a part of it where you work a lot where that all kind of gets left. You know, you have to make time for your children, but then there's a husband who's there somewhere in the midst that you're trying to also be a wife. And so I think it's an amazing idea. And yes, tax wise, it's brilliant. And also, if you guys are interested in buying a plane, you can also do like the Uber version of it where you can rent it out and, you know, you can make money other ways with it. But I think it's something where if I flew private for years with Dillard's, not having to go through TSA, the money and the time you get back that you could work because you're not waiting in line and doing all this stuff in airports is game changing. Like, it's a whole different world. It's wonderful. So I commend you for it.
Yeah, we can also stack trainings like, you know, pretty close by and just hop over on the plane where it'd be like impossible to do that commercially. So yeah, I mean, it's been important. And yeah, I mean, marriage is hard. I've been married for a decade and we have our ups and downs. We waited 7 years before we had kids. And that was because I was in a doctorate program and that first baby that we had was when we started Ruma. So we've only known the chaos of Ruma and kids at the same time. And it's hard, you know, and I think traveling together has been probably the best thing for my marriage, bringing him with me. George also joined our practice as a full-time COO, CFO the last 6 months. And that's been amazing too. Just now feeling like we're actually in it together as a partnership, when before he was always helping on the finance end, but it was more kind of as an irritant because it was an added thing to do on top of his other 9 to 5. And now it's like his baby and he's just so smart. And the vision that he has on the business side is amazing. So it's just kind of lit another fire underneath me and it's kind of propelled Ruma. I mean, we're making lots of changes right now. So it's been outstanding to have him on board.
Well, I think about that from your perspective. You know, I call you America's sweetheart all the time. You don't know that, but I'm always like, just call America's sweetheart. As we talked about you with like Brittany and, you know, all of our friend group, because I feel like you are, as you mentioned in the beginning, very strong about what you believe in and kind of your core ethical compass. But you have a very public life. You know, you are, we talk about a lot, you know, being a celebrity in our little niche of our world. I mean, you're very famous in our little world. How do you balance that though? Because I feel like there's a lot of pressure there that you can never step out of line. You can never have a mishap. You know, you've done it without being controversial. You don't go on Instagram and rant and rave. You don't bad talk anyone. Like, you've done it with your, you know, your nose, your heart, and your head clean and clear. Do you feel pressure around that? And do you feel like that's the thing that, you know, as you're flying in a plane and you're going all these practices and doing all these things, like, keeping all of it together and not falling apart publicly because of that image?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's tons of pressure. And that's the thing I hate about Instagram, to be honest, because so many people see the plane, they see all the things and they think, oh, she's lucky. You know, they don't see the grind. They don't see the hustle, the tears, the hours and hours and hours of work up till 2 a.m., 3 a.m., gosh, almost every night the first few years, you know. I know you know how that is because neither of us sleep. I mean, I got onto a little bit of medical cannabis and that has been a game changer for my anxiety and insomnia. But before that, I mean, I did not sleep. My brain just would never turn off and it's just go, go, go. So, you know, I've had to learn to let go of control, you know. I saw my dad do this really well. My first job was working within his insurance and annuities company. And he's a phenomenal entrepreneur. And I would see the way he would work with his team, how he would empower them and not micromanage them, and how he would give up a lot of control. And he told me in the beginning, when I told him I was going to start my own business, he was a little worried because he knew who I was. He knew how I was, and he knew I would just go 100 miles an hour. So he said, Shelb, I know you're going to put 120 into this always, but doing that constantly, especially if you want to be a mom and a wife and a sister and have hobbies and have a good life, it's not sustainable to just go 120 always. So the second you have someone in your circle who can do something 80% as good as you, you got to delegate it. You got to let it go. And so I've really kind of taken that to heart and have brought on some amazing people. And I'd say they operate better than 80% of what I can do. But I think it's about just finding amazing people that can help grow what you're trying to grow. You know, I don't have an end goal in mind. I don't want to be to a specific number, you know, by a specific day. That's not the goal. The goal is just to maintain our core values in what we do. And it just grows naturally, you know? So you have to find people that believe in what you believe in and that are willing to sacrifice a little bit to help the whole team get there. You know, I love the quote. It says, forget work-life balance, do the thing that you want and create systems to support that. Perfectly imbalanced in the direction you want to go is perfectly acceptable, because you're never going to have balance, right? I mean, I need so much help, especially personally in my personal life. I have two household managers. They're amazing. They do everything for us. They cook, they clean, they do all of our laundry. They put the laundry away. I get home, my kids are bathed, they're fed, and I can spend some quality time with them, 2 hours, where I don't have to worry about coming home and doing dishes or going to grab groceries and trying to throw a meal together and having to clean up or having to catch up on laundry. Those things don't make you a better mom. What makes you a better mom is spending quality time with your kids and actually sitting down and being present with them. And so I've learned to let go of all of those things in order to be able to just turn it on when I have my kids in front of me. I've also like time blocked, especially someone as busy as me, I time block time for my kids. I have to do that. But I feel like if you think about doing all these crazy things throughout the day as a mom, how much time are you actually looking in their eyes, playing and engaging with them, having that one-on-one time? That's powerful. You need to have that time. But so I bet I have just as much time with my kids as a lot of other moms that are staying home doing all these other things. So I've just learned to let those things go. Yes, do the nanny see all my lingerie? And I've had to let that go. Uh-huh. Yeah. There's no personal boundaries, you know? They see everything, but I've let that go. And you know, that's just one example. Personally, I also have like a personal assistant who helps me. She also runs our entire training academy. So you got to have help, you know, it definitely is not all me. And I hope people don't think that, because I mean, all of those people also cost an immense amount of money, but I don't need to make more money. I want a better quality of life. So I'm willing to make a little less to, you know, have better quality of life, but it also allows me to be more efficient and actually make more money that way. So you just got to let go.
Well, that's my 2023 goal, is to hire like a household manager. Cause I have no help. I have Christian's dad's phenomenal, but I have no help. And so I'm doing all the things myself. And so groceries, I mean, we do DoorDash 3 nights a week because I get home late. And to your point, I don't want to sit there and cook for an hour. I have my little boy at home. Like, I think people who are in this world, in any world, who work as hard as we do, I work to want to be able to afford that, to be able to afford the freedom of not having to do my own laundry and cook my own meals. And I'm sure women, you know, in the 50s are rolling over in their graves, like, are you crazy? It's a woman's job. I've got careers to build and trails to blaze, right? We're busy. But I think that's something that people are, to give yourself permission to go hire a person to help you is a thing that I have yet to be able to do for myself. But I listened to you talk about it, and you know, everyone who has these house managers and these people who help them, I got to do it. Like, I either have to clone myself or get one.
Yeah, you have to do it. And honestly, it's how you present it too. When I put the ads out, it's household manager. It's not a nanny, because I don't need a nanny. I don't need someone just taking care of my kids. I don't want that. I don't want them to be enabled and have every need met. You know, I want the person in the home to be another me. I need another mom. I need someone who's doing all those things and being efficient and getting them to swim lessons and managing their schedules and getting them to preschool and picking them up. And, you know, you need a household manager. You don't need a nanny. So if you want my stellar job description and contract, I will send it to you, Tiff.
Send it my way. But, you know, we say here, I joke here a lot about if I do the things that you can do, who will do the things that only I can do? It's kind of like our motto here, because I feel like that's where people in business make a lot of mistakes, is they start doing things that people outside of them could be doing, and then all of a sudden their tasks kind of get left aside. So from a room perspective, thinking about how big you guys are infrastructure wise, what does it take to run that machine? Like from a staff administrative standpoint, aside from you, what are the other leadership roles? I think one of the things we've heard this season on the podcast is like people are shocked to hear you have hierarchies, that you have divisions of labor and you have leaders on the team. And so give us kind of a map of how that looks on that side of the business.
Okay. We have really learned to invest in good people and to pay them well and to create amazing career opportunities for them. And I'm a firm believer in allowing your people to grow up within your business and kind of earn leadership opportunities. So this is what my biz looks like. You have, I'm CEO, my husband's COO, CFO. And then we have a practice manager, and, all of our other managers report to the practice manager, who reports to us. So we have a guest service manager. We have a skin health manager. We have a clinic manager who's been with me from day one. And she runs all the aesthetic assistants. And then we have a brand manager, marketing manager, who runs two marketing specialist marketing coordinators. So each department has a lead, has a manager, so that the practice manager isn't over 30 people. She's over 5 or 6 people. And those people are over 3 to 6 people, right? Because if you're over too many people, things fall through the cracks. And it's hard to maintain culture and make sure everyone's heard and that their needs are met. So that's how we have it structured. Our skin health manager has been with us for years. She worked her way up. She actually started as a guest service manager, and then as a guest service personnel, then became guest service manager. And then I was like, girl, you got to go to skin school, SD school. Let's do this. So she goes to school, and now she became an esthetician, and now she's our skin health manager. So she's worked her way up. Same thing with our guest service manager. She's been with us for years, worked her way up. Sav's, our clinic manager, has been with me from day one for almost 5 years. So I think there's value to having amazing people that can lead their departments and allowing them to do so, right? Giving them the tools to lead a team and helping support them, but not micromanaging them and say, hey, like, I just need you to get from A to B. I don't care how you get there. Just get to B in 30 days. And that's kind of your goal, you know? So, that's how we've structured it. And it seems like it's working well so far.
Well, from a hiring perspective, because I feel like that's where the wheels fall off for all of us from time to time. I, by the way, agree with the same concept. They call it the pizza box rule at Amazon. If it's more than a group that could share a box of pizza or two boxes of pizza, it's too big for a leader. You have to have, I think it's 5 to 7 is a magic number, and then you keep going down. Because my gosh, even the performance reviews, like how could you do them all? How could you have a coaching conversation with 30 people? It's just impossible. But thinking through that, you know, as you look at your hiring process and how you bring people on and onboard them, you know, are there things that you feel like the room away is what makes it different? And that's why the tenures are longer. People stay committed longer. Like, how do you feel like if you were to compare you to, you know, I don't know, some random med spa down the street, what things do you feel like are really your competitive advantage? I feel like that's what we don't know yet in med spas. So we can't figure out, you know, one med spa or the other. What's the compelling reason to come to me and to come to my location versus somebody else who's offering a job?
That's a really good question. I think the first thing is the fact that I refer to Ruma as more of a specialized medical aesthetics practice. It's not a medi spa. I think the problem with so many medi spas is it's someone's side hustle and they're not in it 100%. And it's really hard when the owner is non-medical and non-provider. So I think the advantage that I have is I'm boots on the ground. I'm working with these girls. I'm a huge part of the culture. I'm their leader, but I'm also their medical director. I'm also the one that's pushing them to always learn, you know? So I think that that's a huge separation, but I also think your leader needs to be really strong. And I was not educated on how to be a leader, that's hard. I was kind of thrown into it literally in 10 days. I didn't have a plan to start my own business. It just happened. So I've had to do tons of self work and tons of self-help and leadership books and all sorts of things. But I love the quote by Jim Rohn. It says, your level of success will seldom exceed your level of personal development, because success is something you attract by the person that you become. And I think that's huge, right? It's the law of the lid, right? If your leader is hitting this lid, do you think your people are going to go past you? Like, there's no way, right? So I always have to constantly be working on myself as a leader and be learning. And I mean, there's so many characteristics that make a great leader. And I'm really trying to be better and better and better. But, you know, leaders often like take risks, you know, leaders say things before others say it. They feel things before other people feel it. They do things before other people do it, and then they receive things that other people won't receive, right? We take risks, and it's kind of scary to be a leader, but I'm always trying to be better and better. But I think it starts from the top, and then knowing your core values and having a mission statement and vision and values and knowing what you're for. That was a pivotal book that I read. It's called Know What You're For. Why are we even doing what we're doing, right? Why are we here? In our last team meeting, we sat down because we've had some changes, and I kind of just laid it out. And I'm like, you guys, this is why I'm here. This is why I do what I do every single day. These are our mission, our vision, our values, and I need you to be on board. This is what Ruma is. And I think having a strong leader push that into their people is key, because I've worked at three other med spas where there was no culture. There was no mission statement. There were no values. It was just, I mean, maybe they had them, but they were never brought up. It wasn't part of your day to day, you know? So I don't know, Tiff, I think this industry is tough, but in order to have a successful practice, I think you need to have a practice focused on safety with a really strong leader that looks at this whole thing as medical aesthetics. They're medical procedures, right? We kind of got to elevate what we're doing. And especially if you want to be known as a place, you know, where people kind of flock to.
So I'm reading a book, Dare to Lead by Brené Brown, and I'm learning, I'm not an empathetic person naturally, so I'm learning all kinds of things about empathy and leadership and your teams, and really focusing on like a different, softer side of leadership, because it's not my natural way at all, as my team can attest. I'm a dissociative empath. I'm very empathetic, but behind closed doors, I'll go home and cry about it, but I'll never show you that I'm upset about something. So, you know, those are things that you don't know about yourself until you start leading teams. And all of a sudden you realize you don't know anything about leadership, and you got to kind of start over. And I have a PhD in leadership. I have a PhD in the topic, Shelby. So you think I would know all these things.
Oh my gosh.
It's different to know it, as you know, even from being a practitioner, it's different to know it than to actually go do it. It's a very different skill set to start putting it into play, and then seeing that, you know, people aren't textbook. It's like anatomy. People aren't textbook. The cadaver is not you. You know, things venture off and change courses. But yeah, I love what you said about, you know, you're part of the business. It's really your, you know, what you believe in your core is all over everything that you're doing. But are there things along the way that as you think through that and learning how to be a leader, learning how to be a great business person, that you look back and think, dang it, if I had just made a different decision on that day, or strategically that was not a good choice and it, you know, it set us back. I also believe that everything happens for a reason, so I don't mean that. But are there things that you would say to somebody else, like, hey, here's a watch out you should think about before you start, you know, your own practice or a new building or a new expansion? Those kinds of things.
Yeah, I think medical providers at the core are helpers, right? And we are service oriented. We went into nursing, right? And at least for me, but same thing, PAs, MDs, you go to medical school or whatever school to serve people and help them. So in our industry, there's definitely a drive to learn and educate and to be able to educate others. But when you bring people into your practice and you help build them up and help them become successful, at some point you also have to protect your business. So I think one of my biggest mistakes is just assuming the positive in people always. And I think I kind of love that about myself. But from a business perspective, you have to protect the business, especially the business that now supports 30 other women and families. And if a business keeps taking hits and hits and hits, it's no longer sustainable. So I think one of my biggest mistakes is not protecting my business legally. Social media is a huge part of that. So you also need to have a really good attorney and learn how to protect yourself on social media as you're bringing in new providers. But also learning how to, I mean, mistakes over time, gosh, learning how to value my time. Like, what have I wasted so much time on that I can never get back? Time is the biggest thief, right? I mean, being smarter about your time, and learning to say no. You know, I think as things come up and there's always opportunities to learn and always conferences and always seminars and just learning how to manage my time and learning how to say no over time too has been really pivotal. I don't know, Tiff, tell me what have you learned the last couple of years? I mean, I love Brené Brown's book and we could talk about this too. I one of my favorite things about that book, have you gotten to the rose bush
section? I haven't. No, not yet. Oh, do tell.
This will blow your mind. This blew my mind. Let me give you a little tidbit of it because this has actually helped me get through this last year. I read two books at the same time, Necessary Endings and Brené Brown's book. The Rosebush might be in Necessary Endings, actually, now that I'm saying, but you have to read that one too, especially if you're still learning leadership and like losing people coming onto the team and going off the team. I'm sure it happens all the time with your team. And it does in our industry. That just seems like that's a constant, but it's all about the Rosebush and how you have this beautiful, like blooming rosebush, right? And there's gorgeous flowers and then there's little buds and these little buds have to just like navigate and twist and turn in order to get out around these huge, beautiful, big roses, right? And sometimes as the owner of that rose bush, you have to trim those flowers, even those perfectly blooming, deliciously smelling roses. Sometimes you gotta clip that thing. So four little buds can shoot straight out and succeed, right? Sometimes there's that one little perfect rose that's blocking these tiny little buds, and that's okay. Sometimes it bleeds when you cut out a cancer, and that's okay. And that's something that I've had to learn over the last year, over the last 5, 6, 7 years. And pruning is inevitable and it's directional towards your goals. And that's just what you got to do as a business owner. But I want to know what you've learned the last year.
That's actually a really big one for us too. You know, your first to start your first 50 hires dictate your company forever. Like that's what sets your tone forever. And I'm a big believer in pruning and that if you don't fire fast, you risk everything that you've ever built. You risk the whole company and everyone who works here. And so we are big about that here. If someone's not a great fit, it may not be it's their issue or my issue. It's just not a great fit for our company. I'm quick to say it's done. Like we're done. Leave on good terms, you know, all the things. But we work very hard here on culture. We have like a no drama culture. We have you can never say it's not my job. You have to have, you know, at least help them find the person whose job it is and say, hey, I'm not the best person for it. Maybe somebody else is. Let me connect you. We're very open and transparent. We coach openly here. We don't sugarcoat and hold hands. We're like, hey, we're high performers. And that wasn't high performance. Like, where do we go wrong? What do we do? You know, what do we do that wasn't good? But we're big on this concept right now about paint done for me. Like, what does done look like for you? If I said that this thing is finished and turned in, what is the quality of that work? Because if I have to come in, if it's only 80% there when you turn it into me finished, and I've got to do 20% more work to get it there, you've wasted my time now. Like, I want to know what you think finished is. And so I'll run a team of 30 plus developers who don't know what done means ever. And so I think when you're dealing with, you know, we have a huge international base of people. We have, you know, obviously people here in Dallas, we have remote workers everywhere else. You start bringing in international teams, remote teams, and then on-site teams who do all very different jobs that are vastly different parts of your business. It's a lot of chaos. And so I think the delegation part of it, finding great leaders, letting them lead when they are good leaders, and if they're not, helping them to figure out how to get there and get there quickly. You know, we've grown. or not, or say, you know, we've outgrown you. Yeah, we've outgrown you. And that's okay to say. We were great for you a year ago, but we've outgrown you now, and you haven't been able to keep up. And so I think for us in the last year, we've grown rapidly as a company. Since I've been here in 3 years, we've grown like just, I don't know, 1,000x or if not more. And I love scale. I'm obsessed with scale. I love doing things, SOPs, big. If it's big, hairy, I'm a BHAG kind of girl, big, hairy, audacious goals. Sign me up. Sign me up for it. But I think that's, you know, as you open a med spa as well and you start to grow it, it's the same thing. You know, a great injector who has a great social following, a great Rolodex is great on paper, but in your practice, they could be a rosebush issue that prevents everyone else from, you know, from blooming. And so I think that we are slow in this industry to realize that because we think we're going to lose money. You'll lose so much more money long term by letting cancer stay and fester than just cutting it off and moving on. So Band-Aid, rip it, and call it a day. That's what I've learned.
Yeah, I love that. I think that that's really important. And I think it's okay. I think it's tough. I see a lot of providers that come into our industry and come train with us. I do a lot of business consulting too with people that are starting a small practice. And a lot of the same problems, I mean, they grow quickly and then you outgrow your people. And you love those people. And you've created this emotional loyalty within your team, and you try to give them the chance to get there, but they just don't get there. And we just dealt with this with a practice manager, and that person's supposed to be the leader. When you had 6 people, it was fine, but now there's 26 people, and that's a problem. But it's okay to outgrow people, and you kind of have to separate church and state and the motion from it versus the company that's growing and all the people that need support from that person. Right. And I've had to learn to not be emotional about decisions, to not be emotional. My husband's really good about making non-emotional decisions. So he's very good balance for me, but I've had to learn to not make emotional decisions and to make logical ones for the company.
Yeah, I think if you looked at Amazon, Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, any of the big companies, the first 10 hires probably aren't still there, right? The first 10 that they, because you've outgrown them. I mean,
and
at some
that's
point,
okay. Yeah.
And that's fine. And they went on to build their own businesses that were different. Maybe they were smaller scale. So I feel like it's giving yourself permission to say you've been here forever and you're wonderful, but you're not wonderful for us right now is totally okay. It's just, it's called, I mean, it's just the evolution of business. But, you know, as we kind of wrap up here, which I'm shocked it's been an hour already. I'm just like, I could talk to you forever about everything, but you have, in addition to all this, you also have the Behind the Syringe Squad girls, which I think speaks to the fact that you've mentored both laterally to your colleagues, they mentor to you. You guys have this really great network of women who are strong, powerful, have great practices. You all work together for the betterment of the industry. How much has that affected you as a business owner, even having relationships, having a tribe? I feel like we don't really talk about that enough in the industry to say you have to have friends who are successful and who can help you become successful and learn from. There's a lot of jealousy and infighting in our industry, as you know, but what does that mean for you to have kind of a really close group of people who are moving in the same place, that, you know, the same direction that you're moving in?
A growth environment is a place where others are ahead of me. So I love surrounding myself with people that are incredibly successful, who think differently than me. And I think it's important to network and have colleagues, especially with what we do, especially when you get to this level, to have mastermind groups, to have different types of practices owned by people that you can rub elbows with and say, hey, what's worked for you? You know, my dad also always taught me that a wise man learns from his own mistakes, but a super wise man learns from the mistakes of others. So I'm always trying to learn from other people what hasn't worked within your practice, what's worked. And I think being a trainer early on was really great for me because I was in over 100 different practices before I even started Ruma. And was able to see how they ran and their inefficiencies and how their practice was structured. And I'm all about learning from other people, and it's motivating, and it's also good for my soul, because those types of people, my Behind the Syringe girls, are the types of people that understand what I'm going through. Because a lot of people do not know the pain, the sacrifice, everything that goes into what we're doing, the stress, the pressure. But those girls do. So that's also been really good for my mental health. And I think that you just need a tribe.
Yeah, it's lonely at the top.
Yeah,
it really is. I think to share the burden amongst other people in some way is always emotionally freeing. To keep it all to yourself and have to learn your own lessons. And I think too, to have someone to tell, like if I learned a lesson, I want to tell you, hey, I just did that thing and it ended horribly. Don't do what I did. I feel like I'm a person who naturally wants to share that with someone to say, let me save you the heartache and the pain and the loss of revenue. Don't do that. I just think there's such a benefit in sharing. And I think we as an industry have not yet gotten there. It's still very competitive. Maybe because it's very heavily female here. We're still kind of infighting and competitive, but I hope that we look at people like you. You know, I look at like Lori's the same way. There's, you know, all of you who are doing great things, Julie Kaplan, have these tribes and these groups of people who are, you know, really connected to you. And we see that and think, huh, there's a reason why you guys are all successful and you're staying sane amongst the chaos because you have a tribe. So I love it. Keep doing it.
Oh, thanks, babe.
Well, we'll see you in September at Aesthetic Next. You're doing a workshop with Brittany on tear troughs and upper face, and you're doing a ultrasound talk, and I'm sure there'll be many more things that'll pop up along the way for you to do, which we can't wait to see you. But what's next for you? What's in the next few weeks or months that are your big rocks?
Oh, what's next? We are doing another in-person ultrasound course. That's big for us. We do one at least once a quarter. So we'll do one this summer. Lots of trainings coming up, mainly just really establishing our team here. As we've grown, we are investing in a new brand manager, which I've never had. So I'm so excited to really get the back end of our marketing and getting the whole brand vision going, getting our new practice manager up to speed, and we've brought on more providers. So just really kind of hunkering down and focusing on Ruma as well over the next few months.
Well, if you guys want to find trainings with Shelby, is it RumaAcademy.com? Is that the right website?
Yep, RumaAcademy.com. Yeah.
So go there and sign up and go learn from the master herself, or have her come out to your practice. Make it a really cool destination for her and Jordan to fly to so they can enjoy the weekend.
Yeah, make it interesting and maybe we'll come to you. Yeah.
Maybe you'll win the lottery and she'll come to you. No, I'm kidding. But for the record, you have made season 3, the crescendo, the end of it, fantastic. Like I said, you're a dream guest. To have you on is fabulous. To be a friend of yours is wonderful as well. I'm glad to hear that things are moving in the direction that you want them to and that it's all falling into place, because I think if all people, you deserve it for sure. So we'll keep watching you on social media. We'll keep watching the girls grow up and just be hilarious and precious as they are. So love your family. Love all that you're doing. And we'll see you in September.
Thank you. Same to you, Tiff.
Well, for all the rest of you guys, we'll see you next season for season 4 of For the Record. Bye, Shelby. Bye, guys.
Bye, guys.
Thanks for listening to another episode of For the Record. This podcast is not intended to provide legal or medical advice. It's for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. For more information on this week's guest or to get started with Aesthetic Record, email us at info@aestheticrecord.com. Be sure to tune in next week for more fresh perspectives on disrupting the status quo and surviving in the aesthetics industry.